Friday, April 19th, 2019. It's Idaho Matters. I'm George Prentice. It's Friday. That means it's time for our reporter roundtable, and where we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week around our region, or at least some of the news that made headlines. Our guests today are Don Day of BoiseDev.com, Seth Ogilvie of Idaho Public Television, and Rebecca Boone of the Associated Press. Hi.
Hi, George. Hey. Do we chase Jim off?
Hello.
Well, here we are. No. But eventually they had to go through the phone book. They came to the P's, and so it's my turn. So we've got a lot to talk about. Seth, maybe we could start with Governor Brad Little's 100 days event. I'm not going to call it a press conference because he didn't take that many questions, but let's talk about this event that he held.
Yeah, normally after the legislative session, the governor will kind of come out, give his thoughts on what happened. Normally they do that the day after the legislature ends. He decided instead to do a 100 days press conference where he spent the first 10 to 12 minutes kind of talking about all of his accomplishments, laying out what he thought he got done in his first 100 days in office, and then he started taking questions. He didn't take questions for very long. He only took about 15 minutes worth of questions. Normally, Otter in the past has taken almost an hour of questions, kind of let us get through everything. I know we had a lot of education questions that we didn't get to. The major focus ended up being on the Medicaid sideboards and the voter initiatives and the rules, because all three of those things were, you know, rather large topics in the Idaho legislature this year. I think the big main news takeaway that I got was he kind of said that he didn't veto the Medicaid sideboards because they'd be able to deal with it next year due to the time process. It's going to take about a year for the waivers to come through, so it wouldn't be until March or April of next year. The idea being, if the courts did throw some of these out or the waivers weren't granted, next year Idaho's legislature would deal with this, as opposed to the voter initiative that he thought was necessary to get done right now. So he didn't use the same kind of logic of vetoing it because it'd get tossed out by the courts because of the timeline. It kind of got contentious. It didn't seem like he really wanted to go with a lot of the questions that the reporters had. He almost seemed a little bit unprepared for a lot of these hard questions.
In regards to Medicaid, he was asked about that letter that he attached to his signature when he approved the law. And I want to make sure I've got this right. He said, quoting here, "It obviously wasn't as warm and fuzzy as some people would have liked it to have been."
And your guess is as good as mine of what he's referring to, because he did talk about a lot of these sideboards as things that the voters wanted, as things that he wanted, as things that legislators wanted. I think probably what he's referencing is the work requirements, which I think a lot of people are skeptical of whether or not the waiver will even be granted and whether a court will let Idaho implement those, because the 4th District Court over on the eastern side of the country has already thrown out very similar work requirements when it comes to Medicaid, saying Medicaid is a function of giving people health insurance, not training people to work. And those two things shouldn't be combined.
Can we talk briefly about hemp? The governor said, "I'm not against hemp. My position with hemp all along is I don't want hemp to be a camouflage for recreational marijuana."
Yeah, I think, again, maybe not a very good understanding of what hemp is.
Yeah.
Because hemp and marijuana are two very different things. We talked a little bit about the truck driver who is stuck in prison right now. The governor seems to think that since he pled guilty, it's kind of a done deal and that it's not his problem. I think a lot of people feel a little bit of sympathy for a poor truck driver who's sitting in jail for possibly up to 5 years because his business told him to drive through Idaho. He also said a suggestion to other truck drivers is go through California.
Rebecca Boone.
Yes.
I am fascinated by a story that you've been reporting on from the federal courthouse here in Boise. It involves a young girl who was in middle school when she was sexually assaulted in the Shoshone School District, I think it was.
Right. So the Shoshone Middle School and the Shoshone High School are actually connected in one building. They kind of have separate wings, but it's all one building. And this girl, she was 13. And when there was sexual contact, I'll say, between her and a 17-year-old student.
So a high schooler.
A high schooler.
Yeah.
In that combined building's computer lab. That was locked. There's security cameras in there, but it wasn't discovered right away until ultimately a teacher came in, or rather the school principal, I think, after the activity, the assault had ended, and was like, "What are you kids doing here?" And they said, "Oh, we're watching Netflix." And she said, "You need to get out of here." And then later was chatting about it with the school counselor, and the counselor said, that sounds really shady, a, you know, 17-year-old and a 13-year-old alone in a room. They watched the video cameras and saw this sex assault occurring. So the 17-year-old was quite a while later, because court cases take a long time, ultimately convicted of lewd conduct with a child under the age of 16, because just to get out there, in Idaho, you cannot consent to sex if you are 13. You can't do it if you're under 16. It's illegal. They don't have the ability to consent. That's what our law says. That's what almost every state law says.
That is, of course, unless you're married, because Idaho does allow 13-year-olds to marry, in which case then you could consent to sex at that point.
Theoretically.
Yes.
Yes.
This case is much more than that incident, though.
Right.
It is about what has happened to this young girl and her family.
Right. So this was what kind of triggered it. But ultimately, what's happening in the federal courthouse now is a lawsuit. This girl and her family have sued the Shoshone County School District because they say that they violated a federal law called Title IX that requires schools to basically make sure that they are a safe and not a hostile environment to students who have been sexually assaulted in some way. Title IX is a really big, complex law. It's also about why we have to have, say, women's, you know, an equal number of women's sports as opposed to men's sports in schools, things like that. But part of it is about how schools deal with sexual assaults, the steps they have to take to ensure their students are safe there, and whether or not they're showing deliberate indifference when there has been a sexual assault alleged.
It's my understanding that this young lady suffers from PTSD. The family moved away from the district. They claim they're destitute. This is rather significant, and I'm guessing that's the reason for them suing the district for
quite a bit
of money.
Yes, exactly. So they're for, if I remember correctly, about $500,000, but I'd need to check my notes on that.
Okay.
Or no, sorry, at least $5 million, rather.
Okay.
So they say that they wanted their daughter to be able to return to school, right, and to be able to keep attending school at Shoshone Middle School and ultimately high school where they lived. But they say they felt unable to do that unless the person who was eventually convicted, the 17-year-old, was transferred to a different school. They say that the school officials did not give them a safety plan or any indication of how she could attend school safely, even with the other student there. They also say that they opted to, for a time, while all this got figured out, to have the student take her, to have the younger girl take her assignments at home, right? Have the teacher send her assignments home so she could keep up with her schoolwork and all of that, and then return them and do it that way. So not homeschooling, but rather doing the school assignments at her home residence. But they say that the teachers in the school didn't send very many assignments home, you know, and so basically they felt like it was impossible and ultimately ended up transferring her to Gooding and moving there so that she could attend school there, which for a family that didn't have a lot of money to begin with, they say basically, you know, we have nothing.
But her life and their lives were upended for certain.
Right. I mean, and but whose fault is that is what this lawsuit is going to decide. Now, the school says we sent assignments home. We were just waiting for this family to say when the girl wanted to return to school, and then we would have given them a safety plan and all of these things are considered transferring this other student. But the family says we didn't get any of that. So that's where the he said, she said, in effect, comes in here. You know, the school says we did everything we need to do. We were just waiting for the family to let us know what they wanted. The family says, look, we wanted her to go back to school, and you guys didn't do anything to help us get her there.
Right. It's about doing the right thing.
It doesn't sound like the school district or the school really took any affirmative action in this at all. I mean, to me, hearing that there's a 17 and 13-year-old alone in a room at school seems that there should probably be a policy change just right there. I haven't heard necessarily that they've changed their policy up. It sounds like a family in crisis, the onus shouldn't be solely on them to make sure that this poor girl is safe in school. It seems like the school, again, should take some affirmative action. I mean, is that basically
the definition of Title IX?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of there's a lot of actions that that the school can take, and I think there are many that the school probably did take. There were meetings, you know, at least some meetings between the family and the school officials. There were at least some assignments at home, but really that's where the nuance is here that the jury is going to have to figure out. They're going to have to figure out, did the steps that the school took. You know, was that enough to ensure, to show that they were trying to eliminate a hostile environment for this girl? Or did they not do enough? Did they act with basically deliberate indifference? You know, and there's some other stuff going on here too. The older student is described in the lawsuit as a star athlete who's had a parent who was really involved with the team in which he was a star athlete for, and that brought the school a lot of, you know, accolades in sports. Mm. And so there's kind of these hints of allegations that they were favoring perhaps the older student because he was good for the school athletically. But again, it's high school. It's not college sports. So, you know, I think the counterpoint to that would be, what is that, you know? What good does it really do necessarily?
What's the value
high school
of that? Yeah.
What's the value? I don't know.
Excellent. Don Day, Boise
yes.
Dev.
Yes, hi.
Let's talk about public transportation.
Let's do it.
So the Boise City Council this week had a public hearing on public transportation options or lack thereof. The thing that I was trying to figure out is, why did they have this public hearing?
So
is something, is it, was it attached
yeah.
to something?
So let's zoom out just a little bit. Public transit in our area is funded through each of the cities by contributing dollars to Valley Ride, Valley Regional Transit.
Mm-hmm.
And the city of Boise is the largest contributor to that pool.
By
as
far.
You can imagine. And 90% of boardings and people getting off the buses happen in the city of Boise. So even though it's a Valley-wide system, Boise has a big say. In January, Councillor Elaine Clegg said that she wanted to not just have the dollars the city allocates happen as part of the normal process, but to break it out so mm-hmm. that citizens could have a say. She has proposed that the city work towards providing 5% of its property tax collections each year mm-hmm. towards Valley Ride. Now, funding for Valley Ride in Boise continues to grow in dollars, but has shrunk in terms of percentage of the budget. And that's because property values here are appreciating, and the city, of course, has been raising its collection. So what she wanted to see was an extra $1 million come from the city budget towards VRT, split between 2020 and 2021. So they held a public meeting, and what I did on Boise Dev, because what happened in the meeting wasn't really new.
Right.
Everything we kind of already knew.
Yep. We want more options, more frequency.
Yeah, but yep. The public hearing was really interesting because you got to hear from a couple dozen folks on, boy, what do you want to see in the bus system? And there was some at times really moving stories about people who just can't get around.
Mm-hmm.
There was one gentleman who said that his car broke down and he's going to have to move back to Seattle because he can't get to his job. And so the public hearing was really interesting. Public transit in Boise is not well used. It is actually has seen declines in total use, especially as compared to the population growth. And leaders at Valley Regional Transit say, well, that's because the system needs to get better and we need more money to do it. They've put forth a set of proposals that in one instance they would hope would boost ridership by 800%. They would do that by finding a lot more dollars. The elephant in the room, this whole thing, was local option tax. The mayor of Boise, even the mayors of Meridian, Twin Falls, and some other places have said, come on, we need a chance
yeah.
to ask our voters to add a penny or two to the sales tax to fund transit. And the mayor, Mayor Beter, has been very insistent on this point. He was hopeful that there might be a way to move forward and let the state of Idaho as a whole vote on whether to allow a local option tax because the legislature was not able to get its restrictive law on the initiative process all the way through. So we'll see. Time
every
is of the essence because I think it's going
to
come back next year.
Every time I've talked to the mayor about this,
yeah,
he is in support of a ballot initiative, but he doesn't want to be the face or the voice of that ballot initiative.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, politically challenging. The state of ADA is a phrase that I don't hear so much in the streets of Boise anymore, but I know throughout mm-hmm. the state it's
yeah.
a big thing. When I talked to Governor Little earlier this year, I asked him about this, and he actually seems broadly supportive of this. It just has to be how do we figure out how to do it? And I think everybody's realistic that the Idaho legislature in its current makeup isn't going to ever approve a local option tax. In fact, I actually asked Jim Weatherby about a year ago, who knows the legislature better than I think anybody, and he sort of said, not happening.
And if anything, the legislature this year may have done something to complicate it even more with passing that urban renewal bill
for
that
sure.
would put things up to a vote. You're saying $1 million in. If there's a couple of dollars of urban renewal money that's going into that, based on how I read that bill, that would have to go to the people for a vote.
Yeah, so this is not capital improvements. It's operational, so I don't think it actually...
So only if they were building a building or something like that.
Yeah, and I think there's some minor, potentially some minor things in there on capital, but for the most part, it's operations.
You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm George Prentice. With me on this week's Reporters Roundtable are Don Day of Boise Dev, Seth Ogilvie of Idaho Public Television, and Rebecca Boone of the Associated Press. Let's jump back in. Seth, Congressman Mike Simpson was in town during one of the breaks, and he made some interesting comments about undocumented workers.
Yeah, he basically laid out an idea that I don't think we've heard from him or very many people in the United States before. The idea was we've got a lot of undocumented folks in the Idaho and in the U.S. They're all here, in his mind, working for a better life. And they shouldn't just all be deported. Mm-hmm. His suggestion that he made earlier this week was give them all permanent green card status. That is a pretty big policy idea. I mean, that would put shockwaves through the entire country if something like that happened. What I thought was interesting is people just kind of ignored it. And I'm not sure if that's the idea that they don't think Simpson could accomplish this or they just don't think D.C. in general could accomplish anything like that. And it kind of went on with their life. He said things similar to this in the past. He's always kind of tried to find a line to walk where you're not deporting undocumented folks in the U.S. Mm-hmm. because, you know, agriculture in Idaho is very important. There's a lot of farm workers, a lot of dairy workers, a lot of people in the service industry that are undocumented. Mm-hmm. And we need those folks for the Idaho ag economy to work.
But what an interesting voice to have those words. I'm sure it was a friendly audience, and that reception was just fine for him at a chamber event in Boise.
And I wasn't there, but the reporter for the Idaho Press who was there said that a hush went over the room.
Yeah.
Like, even there, people were surprised by this.
Wow.
And talking to some folks who have touchstones with the Hispanic, Latinx community, mm-hmm. it seems like even them, they were just like, oh, moving on, that's never going to happen. So it's just kind of interesting to see such a huge policy idea dropped and everyone just not really care.
I think it got less attention than when the governor acknowledged climate change in January, which got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. This, similarly surprising from a Republican in Idaho, and kind of just went sailing by.
Especially in the context of the Trump administration and a lot of the feelings on immigration policy here in the Republican Party in Idaho, I think Mike Simpson's kind of out on his own with this idea within his party.
Okay, Rebecca, let's talk about the same-sex parent rights lawsuit in the Idaho Constitutional Defense Council, paying nearly $250,000 in legal fees. And again, it's Idaho's abysmal record in court challenges.
Right. So what you need to know about the Idaho Constitutional Defense Fund is it's a pot of money that was created in, like, 1995, mm-hmm. mainly to, like, advance and promote and defend state sovereignty issues against the federal government, but has been almost exclusively used, with a couple of exceptions, to pay the court costs when Idaho loses in court over, you know, like, laws that are found to be unconstitutional or whatnot. So that's what happened in this case. There was a woman who sued because the state refused to put her name on the birth certificate of her child. Now, she had the child with the same-sex partner. Her partner was the birth mother. This was before gay marriage was legal in Idaho, so they couldn't get married. The state's reasoning for not putting her name was because she wasn't the birth mother and because she wasn't married. So they say there was no way to put it on. She sues in federal court. She wins. The judge says, you got to pay the court costs, Idaho. And so Idaho... this week, met the Constitutional Defense Council, includes the governor, you know, legislative leadership, Attorney General Wasden, and they, in an incredibly quick meeting, said, well, we've been ordered to pay these court costs. Yep, let's pay them. And the total, it was more than $277,000. Now, there's still about $1.3 million left in the Constitutional Defense Fund, but it gets replenished with our tax dollars by the legislature on a regular basis whenever it gets too low.
But we're already talking about legal challenges to the results of this legislative session.
And we're also talking about possibly relitigating a lot of these things because at least in the birth certificate case, Judge Dale told the state of Idaho to change the rules. This year in that rules package, that rule was going through to make that court order happen. Those rules just got thrown out, which talking to one of Candy Dale's clerks, That doesn't necessarily mean that the litigation will start up again, but it definitely opens the door for petitioners to start relitigating all of these rules throughout the years that came out of court order and say, no, we're going back to court because that rule doesn't exist anymore.
And that's like in every agency has these rules because of these lawsuits. I mean, think about health and welfare and what we, you know, what the state pays to providers. There's been, you know, administrative hearing processes that have led to lawsuits, that have led to rule changes, all sorts of things.
Okay, Don Day, let's talk stadium.
Okay,
let's write another chapter in this ongoing saga. And what's interesting, though, the real news is that Boise State has returned to the conversation about the possibility of a stadium in the city of Boise.
Yeah, so Boise State issued a news release earlier this week saying that they were talking to Greenstone Properties, which owns the Boise Hawks and is trying to figure out how to build a stadium in downtown Boise with the city of Boise.
And, now take us back, because the former president, Bob Custra, was pretty insistent on not doing a deal with the
city. He was, and so he wasn't, and then he was. He initially, they were talking about it, and then all of a sudden just said, nah, we're going to do our own thing.
Yeah.
And I reported some emails back and forth with Chris Shane at Greenstone Properties in the city of Boise saying, well, now that Custer's gone, does it make sense to talk to the new guy? And I've also got some reporting on Boise Dev that talks about a kind of an odd little note where the Greenstone developer said, well, I don't know if Joe Scott made a big contribution to make them go away the first time, which was kind of an odd thing. So Joe Scott is Joe Albertson's grandson and was involved in the stadium project at Shoreline and not having that happen there. Okay. And so then there's this kind of odd email where he says, well, I don't know if Joe Scott, you know, did something with the school, but now that Custer's gone, we might have a chance. Kind of an odd couple of notes there. Margaret Carmel, your colleague over at the Idaho Press, had some fantastic reporting out of Public Records that talked about just what Boise State wanted. They said they wanted to own half the stadium when it was over. They wanted priority scheduling for fall baseball games. They wanted some naming rights. They wanted a 1,200-square-foot locker room. They have a very extensive list of what they would require from Greenstone to make this happen. So just because Boise State has said there's some interest does not mean that that is a done deal. Boise State was very specific in its news release in saying that the work on a separate baseball facility on Beacon Street near the Boise State campus continues. A lot to be written on this story. I said on
that
I Don't Matters a few weeks ago.
That said, by this time next year, their baseball team is going to be playing without a stadium.
Yeah, well, and
I mean, they're going to play at Memorial.
They're going to play at Hawks Memorial Stadium. And I did a long story on BoiseDev.com this week that looks at all the land needs for this potential stadium. And there's just a tangle of owners and complications and things that they have to clear. This isn't easy. They may have one or two public votes that they could have to face. But you can see that the developers are still moving forward, still trying to make it happen. City of Boise actively involved. And now you have Boise State playing a part. It's a fascinating story to cover, and we're, I think, 52 stories deep now. So,
one for every week. Thank you so much. Many thanks to our guests for this week's Reporters Roundtable, Don Day of Boise Dev, Rebecca Boone of the Associated Press, Seth Ogilvie of Idaho Public Television. Have a lovely weekend. It's a gorgeous day today.
We do. I'm ready to get back outside.